Hey friends, summer's longer days and slower pace invite us to pick up a book, follow our questions, and try our hand at something new. The work of modern software developers is evolving in ways that are both challenging and rewarding. As a developer, it's essential that you cultivate a security mindset. And to help, we've put together a collection of information security books, podcasts, blogs, and hands-on exercises recommended by VeraCoders across our development, security, and product teams. From a just-published page-turner to classic FRAC articles, there's something here for everyone who's interested in becoming more security-minded. So dip your toes in or take a deep dive. Visit veracode.com/reading. That's veracode.com/reading. This is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and today I'm talking with Cheryl Conti. She is the author of Mechanical Bull, How You Can Achieve Startup Success. I just read this on my Kindle, and it was fantastic.
Well, thanks, Scott. It's great to be here.
Yeah, this is an interesting story about it's functional advice, but it is also your story about how you, started. You have had multiple startups now and had an exit, sold your startup, and some really significant advice, because traditional startup advice doesn't kind of always apply to everybody, does it?
It really doesn't. And I think that people often assume, like here, for example, the friends, and there's something called the friends and family round, where it's assumed that you have raised a bunch of money from, your colleagues, from your friends and your family. And, as a technologist from a pretty humble background, I make the most in my family, or I'm one of them. And, Peanut and Ray Ray are asking me for money. Right. So there's no, my friends and family round would have gathered about $200. So, I think that, I really tried hard in the book to say, look, if you've got a really great idea and you've got the energy and the ambition, no matter who you are, no matter where you're from, here's what you need to know about the life cycle of startups to be successful.
Right. And you walk people through the raising of the money, the different ways that you can raise money, the different ways that you can exit. But one of the things that I thought was interesting, just in part one, right off the bat, you asked the question, do you have what it takes? And I know that you feel strongly that kind of the term gatekeeping is important, that we don't want to have gates that we prevent people from entering entrepreneurship. But you do very clearly say that it's not for everyone. And you might need to ask yourself the hard question, are you an entrepreneur?
Absolutely. I mean, look, it's part of the American character, right? Of, having your own business, even being your own boss. And that's good. That's a good thing. But look, if your dream is, look, I want to work from home in my pajamas, and I'm going to, quote, be my own boss, that all sounds well and good. But here's the thing, imagine having, instead of one boss, like bosses as far as the eye can see, who are your clients and customers. Does that appeal to you, or does that frighten you? Right. Mm-hmm. If you're working from home, in your pajamas, there's a good chance that A, you're working from home because you can't afford an office yet, and B, you're working in your pajamas because you have been working straight, you don't have time to put on pants. So I try to just keep it really real in the book. And also, like, look, are you a self-motivator? Some people really do work better being in an office with other people. And oftentimes when you're launching your own business, there's a lot of time when you are working with a much smaller team or on your own. And, if you're not the kind of person who will get up, assign yourself, to quote Marion Wright Edelman, founder of Children's Defense Fund, if you're not the kind of person who will get up and assign yourself, but instead left to your own devices in your home office, will just consume a whole bunch of YouTube and maybe a chocolate cake, like, entrepreneurship is not for you. Like, you've really got to know yourself.
That is really difficult. Like, you have to do the work, but how do you make sure that you're not saying, like, try harder, or, as I think Sheryl Sandberg famously said, lean in? Like, there's leaning in, and then there's leaning in.
Yeah, look, leaning in doesn't mean the same thing to, I think, every person. And, you know, I do think there are, you know, the timing is important, right? And one of the things I think to consider is this the right time for you, right? Are you pregnant, right? And are about to have a baby. This might not be the optimal time to launch that startup. I know people who have done it and some people can handle that. But for other people, they might say, you know what? I want to wait a couple years. You know, I want to get my grounding. You know, I want to, you know, get my kid up and running. I want to heal, you know, my body, you know, or, you know, make sure everyone's taken care of. And then I want to switch my focus.
Right. And that's just one example. It could be, are you in the right place with your parents? Are they healthy? Are they, I know people who have family situations where like, this is not the right time. I want to spend time with my kids, with my family, with my partner, with my whatever.
Well, and finances, you know, have you really lined up? And one of the things I talk about in the book, right, in terms of are you an entrepreneur, are you comfortable being paid last? Because, you know, a lot of people think, oh, you know, I'm going to launch this business and I'm going to be rich. But, you know, ultimately, especially in that first year to 18 months, you know, you might have vendors or suppliers to pay, right? You might have employees to pay and all of those. All, that's your responsibility. You know, that's your commitment is to make sure everybody else is whole. And then what's left over is for you. And so, you know, do you have, you know, enough of a foundation such that you can weather, you know, an occasional week or two waiting to get paid, you know, instead of getting paid, for example, regularly every 2 weeks?
That idea that are you willing to take the risk of being paid last is really, really important and powerful. Like you, when you were doing your startup with your partner, you actually had to pay some of your own money to make payroll. That's a, I don't know if I'd have that level of commitment to my startups.
Yeah, I think it's pretty common. I think it's, you know, and I actually set aside money just in case as just a, okay, here's a slush fund, you know, in case, you know, I need 10K. To make payroll, I'll get it paid back. I was always confident, you know, that we would get, you know, that I'd be made whole. But right, I mean, that takes a certain amount of self-discipline, you know, and maturity to say, look, I know that I have to set aside a certain portion of my income just in case I have to be my own line of credit until I can get a line of credit. It can take, oftentimes banks want to see 2 years worth of business, a business being alive before they're willing to extend a line of credit. And yet most businesses, as you know, fail within the first year. So that means, you know, you may need to be your own line of credit and manage your money very carefully along the way.
One of the things that came up in the book, and I was actually a little surprised about, was it appeared to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you used examples of your own life where you were doing startups early. You know, I did this at 14. I did that at 13. I was thinking entrepreneurially in my mid-teens. And I thought to myself, well, I've done that too. And I know people who have done that. But I also know people for whom that's not intuitive or natural. How important is it that we get young people thinking about these things, and whether it be lemonade stands that turn into B-Sweet Lemonade, which is like a legit company and you can buy it at Whole Foods. Is that really entrepreneurship, or is that just kids being kids?
Well, I think kids are naturally entrepreneurial, and you know, the instinct of, you know, the marketplace, right? The village marketplace. I mean, marketplaces are something that is an ancient human activity. So I think that you may identify in your kid, you know, that kid who's always kind of on their game, right? On their hustle. Mm. So, you know, in the book I describe, I had a little boyfriend in nursery school and kindergarten. And, you know, kids really like to see us kiss. We would lean in, we would stand like 2 feet away from each other and then, you know, slowly, you know, find, you know, lean in so that we would find each other's lips. And kids, other kids found this behavior fascinating, right? Like our quote, passionate love affair. So, you know, and so they'd be like, kiss, kiss. So at some point I said, you know what, people, they should be paying us. Like, you know, I'm not a monkey. Okay. This isn't a zoo. So for big kids, like, you know, maybe fourth grade and up, they it cost them 25 cents if they wanted to see us kiss. For, you know, young kids our age or younger kids, it was more of a sliding scale. It's kind of, you know, what have you got, right? Anywhere from a penny to a dime. And so, you know, my little boyfriend at the time, Stevie, was more of a romantic and had some issues with, you know, the selling essentially of our love. And to keep him, to mollify him and keep him in the business, you know, I could buy, you know, eventually I would scrape up enough so that we could buy, you know, candy or ice cream. But like, you know, it was in me, right? It was definitely in me to do that. And you may have a kid who's sort of just got these ideas and is always trying to, you know, who or like is really passionate about Monopoly, right? And like really likes that kind of game or just, you know, asks mm-hmm. certain kinds of questions. And, you know, you can nurture that. I remember I want to say it was the sixth grade. This isn't in the book. This is special for Hansel Minutes listeners. We actually filled out, they taught us in school randomly for no apparent reason, how to write a check. And it just felt like such an adult activity. It had never occurred to me to write, to like, you know, and explain like how a check works and how banking works. And, you know, it just switched on a light in my brain that I wouldn't use, of course, until later, but you'd be surprised. You know, I think that's why there's this emphasis on teaching kids to code now, you know, as early as possible. It's not that, you know, you necessarily want to force your kid to become a developer or a software engineer, but coding, it's like Shakespeare or algebra. It changes something in your brain, you know, and about you to engage in that activity such that even if you don't use it later, you know, you have opened up new doors and new capacity inside yourself. So that's why I think it's important to encourage entrepreneurship in kids, even if they don't end up launching their own business. They've learned something about themselves and about how the world works. You know, that's gonna shape them in a positive way.
Yeah, I feel like it is about agency and about empowerment. And one can decide to sell lemonade. I always use that as a great example. Every kid should do that, or Girl Scout cookies. Or if you can, you know, I drew comic book art. So I would draw art, photocopy it, and sell it for 25 cents. And then I got a table at the local comic convention and sell prints for a dollar, kind of thing. The idea that I could create something out of nothing, thereby creating value, and then participate in economy gave me a sense of empowerment and agency as a kid, I think.
Absolutely. All of a sudden you see yourself as a person who can move independently in the world and who, you know, has created something of value that other people want, as opposed to being someone who is a taker, right? Which as a kid, you know, one feels a lot of the time like a taker.
Mm-hmm. So when you have the idea, when you come up with the idea, how important is it that that idea fill a gap versus what some of the things that we're seeing now where they are simply commodities that are delivered more efficiently than before? I think those are two different kinds of products.
Those are two different kinds of products, actually. I think both are important. Look, you know, I wrote this book such that, you know, anyone who has a great idea and the energy and ambition to unleash that idea into the world, you know, wants to do that in order to improve people's lives. And there's a lot of different ways to improve people's lives, right? One of them, right, is just getting, you know, people food, you know, in a more efficient, faster, healthier way. Right? Everybody eats. You know, food is not new. Achieving food in your mouth is not new. But, you know, maybe having, you know, Uber drop off your food, maybe that's new.
Hey, friends. As a software engineer, chances are you've crossed paths with MongoDB at some point, whether you're building an app for millions of users or just figuring out your side hustle. As the most popular non-relational database, MongoDB is intuitive and incredibly easy for development teams to use. Now, with MongoDB Atlas, you can take advantage of MongoDB's flexible document data model as a fully automated cloud service. MongoDB Atlas handles all the costly database operations and admin tasks that you'd rather not spend time on, like security, high availability, data recovery, monitoring, and elastic scaling. Try MongoDB Atlas for free today. Visit mongodb.com/cloud. That's mongodb.com/cloud to learn more.
Okay, so I've got an idea and I'm going to go and build a team.
In the book, you invoke the idea of the visionary and the geek, kind of the Ballmer and the Bill Gates, or the yin and the yang. How important do you think it is to have that partner?
Oh, essential, essential. And I think, you know, particularly, you know, people who might be maybe you're what they call a non-traditional entrepreneur, right? You know, oftentimes people are, they feel like they it's taken them so long to get here, right? And they're an army of one, right? They see themselves as like, I can, you know, I've gotten here and that was hard and I can do anything. But actually what investors in particular are looking for is your understanding that you don't know everything and you can't do everything. Right. And that's an important, like, is there any humility? Because, you know, any good business ultimately is going to be a function of the quality of the team, and a team that is multifaceted and multifunctional. So the visionary is that person who, can wax rhapsodic about the technology, about how it's going to change people's lives, you know, who is really great at representing and you know, telling the story of the product. But the geek is someone who may or may not be that, you know, out front, but is someone who has a lot of technical expertise and can really actually implement and make it happen. And those two are equals. You can't really have one without the other.
Mm-hmm. And is the idea to have two people because just simply it's just too hard to have one person do all this kind of work?
I've just found it rare that all of that is in one person. Sometimes it is. Mm. You know, sometimes, you know, you find someone who can embody all of those things. But you know, generally speaking, there's someone who often leans more and is just, it's easier for them in one direction being the visionary. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's another person who is, focused on the implementation. So, you know, another example might be Tim Cook and Steve Jobs, right? Steve Jobs, obviously brilliant, you know, had a lot of great ideas. You know, but ultimately, a lot of Tim Cook's job behind the scenes was to actually take those great ideas and make them into something, mm-hmm. right? And when, you know, he was an automatic heir to the throne when Jobs left, you know, partly because they'd just been working, you know, so long together. But there are other roles that are important. You know, you want to make sure that you have a sales lead. You know, that's probably not the same person. It might be the same. Mm.
Okay, so you're saying that people should find a partner that has different skill sets, but also are complementary. Complementary partners are important.
Absolutely. No one can do anything in this world alone, ultimately. And that is doubly true of a startup. You absolutely need to have, say, the visionary, the geek, the sales lead. If you're making a product, you know, is there someone on your team who has manufacturing experience? You know, who's a product specialist? There are a few key roles that you absolutely have to have on board, you know, in order to be successful. And it's rare that all of those talents, that all of any talents, exist within one person. You know, there's a reason why, for example, at the circus, there's someone who is a lion tamer and someone who's on the trapeze. These are usually not the same person, right? Different skill sets to bring you a show.
I appreciate that. Okay. So I've got a lot. I mean, like people like to say that they're a founder, you know, like I have offices everywhere, you know, they're all, you know, Panera Bread locations, but you know, it's my startup, right?
Sure. Yeah.
Offices nationwide, you know, and if you register a domain while you're in San Francisco, you're officially a founder. But how do you graduate from side hustle to your main gig?
Well, you'll know that you have graduated from side hustle to your main gig when you have the funds to pay yourself a salary and potentially a few other people too. Mm. So, you know, that's the trick, right? Is, you know, are you able to sustain yourself enough such that you no longer need the side hustle, you know, while you have the full-time job, you know, to float your expenses, but you're able to shift gears. So it's actually happened to us where one of our team members, she's a junior accounting professional. She's really smart, but her Instagram influencer business has taken off such that she actually makes more doing that now. And in the foreseeable future, she can see that she can maintain, her expenses and her lifestyle and doesn't need her daytime gig anymore. So,
wow.
Yeah, right? It's a new world we're living in.
So that just like that's a thing that can just happen. You can just slowly build your side business until it becomes your main business.
Until it becomes your main business. And you know, there are a few bridges to get there, right? It, you know, if you want to accelerate that process, you can actually find an accelerator online or an incubator that can help you start to connect to influencers. You can go to the bank and see about, you know, getting a loan and show them your expenses. There are a lot of different programs out there that can help someone go from side hustle to main gig.
I don't have any experience in this space, but of course I'm allowed to have an opinion because I'm an armchair quarterback. I have felt that this idea of an accelerator could potentially be problematic, especially if we're trying to incubate and accelerate underrepresented groups, that they could get in so early that they take huge amounts of someone's company. Like I've seen people on Shark Tank and they'll give them like $30,000 and then they'll take half their company. And I'm thinking to myself, that's like a friends and family round for someone who has no friends or family. And for a modest amount of like, you know, basically amount of money that you'd buy a car with, they just took half your company. Are accelerators good things or bad things? Or is that just that Shark Tank is a bad show?
Shark Tank is a little bit of a distorted. I mean, I went to business school, which definitely helped, but not everyone needs to do that. My original business partner, Rosalind Yu, who's a contributor on the book, didn't go to business school, and she was just as smart and capable, maybe more so than I am. You know, right. So Shark Tank is fascinating from that perspective. It is a good way to learn, you know, what that's like, but it's not really like that. And your investor, you know, the right investors, especially at the seed round, you know, when it's early, when it's angel investors, like, you know, they really want to get to know you as a person. You know, they're not trying to grill you. They're not trying to trick you. You know, look, there are safer ways for an angel investor to make money, right? Okay. Instead of giving you money, like you're probably going to fail, right? Again, 90% of small businesses fail. You know, they'd be better off just dumping that money into an index fund, right? You know, they are angel investors seek out younger entrepreneurs because someone bet on them, right? It's their way of giving back. And it's their way of staying in the game. And so the best investors have more to give than just money and want to. They very much want to be there for you beyond just a financial investment. The financial investment is important and it's meaningful, you know, but ultimately with our angel investors, I felt like, wow, you know, it's, you know, the fact that these really successful people believe in me gives me a lot of self-confidence. And, you know, the best investors, and this is true of Shark Tank, you know, the reason why people say yes, even though they're like, oh, you know, I got to give 20% of my company for like, you know, what feels like, a, you know, $50,000 is because the investors on that show, you know, have these amazing networks, right? And they can provide not just money, but a distribution channel, right? If it's QVC, you know, they can provide marketing support, you know, they have vendor relationships, they can arrange for bank loans, right? So they know that they're going to get a whole different other set of resources from this investor beyond that small amount that's going to blow up their business if they play it right. And so they get a bigger, you know, yeah, you know, maybe you go from owning 100% of your thing to 50% of your thing, but, you know, do you want to own, you know, 100% of like, you know, a penny, you know, or do you want to own 50% of a quarter?
I see. So they can go and pick up the phone and call Toys R Us and have your stuff on the shelf before Toys R Us went under, like tomorrow, because they know the head of Best Buy or Toys R Us or whatever. And that is a value that they, as the angel investor and the incubator, that's why they are an accelerator. They pick up the phone and they call the mover and suddenly your company blows up.
Right. Or they help you work through, okay, you know, here's what you need to do. Here's what you say you're trying to do. You know, let's work on your business model. Let's work on your pricing. Let's figure out vendors and suppliers for you. Oh, you know, we actually need to pair you with another team member, right, to make this happen. altogether. So yeah, you just get so much more with the right, and that's something to look for. I mean, there's good money and there's bad money. And one of the things I talk about in the book, especially as a woman, if someone is, using the opportunity to talk to you about your business to try to get in your pants, like run in the opposite direction, because, that person isn't thinking in a clear, rational way about your business. And if they're doing that now, they will continue to do that. And therefore, they're not going to be that supporter and advisor that you really need when it counts.
I see. Now, one of the things that you called out, though, in the chapter on funding is a thing I had never heard about, but I like the sound of, called steward ownership. I've always used the word stewardship, which is kind of a benevolent kind of ownership. What is steward ownership? And is it finding its way to the States?
It's starting to find its way to the States. So, a great friend of mine who runs the Creative Network actually wrote a blog post about how, he got their company into Matter.VC, which is a really cool accelerator program, but they felt like the people, the VCs, the venture capitalists, and the angel investors that they were talking to just really didn't get what they were trying to do with the Creative Network, which is to have really positive images that people could buy. Right. And so, they weren't trying to, sell to, people who didn't share the same values. They really wanted, images that inspire people. So, steward ownership it's pretty common apparently in Europe. And before, in American history, there's quite a bit of this, but the idea of steward ownership is that companies should exist to do something for society beyond just maximize profit. Right. And I know that sounds crazy, but I think we can see that just maximizing profit, ultimately, doesn't lead to a healthy society. It doesn't even lead to a healthy business. I mean, look at Facebook, right? It's a great example. Facebook did a great job in, selling a whole bunch of ads, but ultimately, people are feeling like, when I go into Facebook, I don't love what I see in there. Right? It doesn't feel healthy. It feels toxic at times. And so ultimately, even though they were trying to maximize for having as many people, as much content as possible on the platform, they would, if they had actually scaled back a little and said, it's not just that we want the most amount of stuff, we want the right stuff, right? They wouldn't be losing engagement.
Now, not to get too political, but is steward ownership capitalist and socialist at the same time? Or is it just acknowledging that not everything has to be more money?
I think it's still pretty capitalist, right? It's still, but it's not saying, so the model here, particularly in the United States, is that, venture capitalists or angel investors, they'll bet on a whole bunch of horses, right? With the idea that one of those horses, one of those companies is going to hit it big. And so everyone is trying to be or present themselves as that one that's going to offset all of the losses, right, from all of the other ones. And so they want to see the hockey stick, right? Meaning, a revenue stream that is going to take off and get huge, right? 100x, 1000x. They're looking for really what's called a really big exit, right? So when you sell or you have an IPO, like a big company like Twitter or just recently Uber, they're looking for that big, big payoff, because all of the other 90% of their bets are likely to fail. Now, instead, with steward ownership, it's capped dividends, or they're sometimes called demand dividends. And what it says is, look, once you reach, a certain amount of revenue, you start paying back the profits to the investors until they've received, say, 5x or 10x their initial investment. So that does two things. It means that the investors get a pretty good return on their money, right? That is safer. In many ways, this makes it a safer bet for an investor, but it also means that they don't have to push towards a sale. It means that, you can actually extend past that 5 to 7 average year if you're a successful business, before you have to exit by either acquisition or IPO. You can keep your business quite a bit longer.
Mm-hmm. And you cover the full life cycle. You cover, you know, you have two parts to the book, but you go all the way through bootstrapping it, funding it, making a pitch deck, how to deal with investors, you know, what the investor expects of you, kind of investor relations, spending, giving your experience and yours and Roz's experience running your businesses and how to, you know, not burn too much cash, all the way out to an exit strategy. And there are multiple potential exit strategies for your company. You talk about a three-way exit, IPO, being acquired, and you actually call out failing as a potential exit.
Failing is the most frequently occurring exit, unfortunately. That's why I call the book Mechanical Bull, in part, is because it's such a wild ride. One day you think, oh my gosh, we made this incredible deal. We're going to be rich. You know, the next day you're like, wow, you know, it was a great ride. You know, we had a lot of fun. We did some cool stuff, but like, it's over, right? Like, this is, and it can feel that way all the way through. I mean, even at the point when we were, you know, in conversations, you know, with, you know, our eventual purchaser, our eventual acquirer. I mean, there were points where we weren't sure the deal was going to go through. I mean, that, which is why I tried to cover the full life cycle so that people feel like they have the tools and the info they need it at every stage to actually get to the other side. You know, it's a tough ride.
Well, you can check out Mechanical Bull on Amazon. I picked it up for my Kindle, and you can follow Cheryl on Twitter. Thanks so much for chatting with me today.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And folks can also find us at dobigthings.today or dobigthings.com, which is my new company.
Fantastic. Well, I encourage everyone to check that out so that they might also do big things. We've been chatting with Cheryl Conti, the author of Mechanical Bull. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.